14% of the plastic we use is recycled. That means 86% of the plastic we use is not recycled. The thought of all that plastic piling up in garbage can Earth leads us to ask, can't we just get along without all that plastic?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1307th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Vancouver who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we were going to watch the equinox sunrise while seated in the sand between the paws of the Great Sphinx up there on the Giza Plateau. Our guide assured us that it would be the most mystical experience. It being very early, I grabbed a large cup of coffee on the way out the door to sip along the way. However, our progress to the Sphinx was halted at the plateau by an armed guard who had been posted there to prevent such adventuring. Not one to be deterred, our guide led us around the block, then over a fence into a graveyard that was covered knee-deep in litter. As we waded along in the dark through that snowdrift of litter, it swished about our knees. Finally, we made it up to the plateau, but only to be halted again by that same armed guard. We did get to see the equinox sunrise that morning, but not while seated between the paws of the Great Sphinx. The sun came up as we waded back through the drifts of litter that covered that graveyard. But then, while walking back along the avenue toward our hotel, I did have my mystical experience. Right there, in my hand, was the same to-go coffee cup I began the adventure with early that morning. For some reason, I had not tossed the cup where everyone else in Cairo had apparently tossed theirs. Cairo did not do a very good job of picking up after itself. Maybe it's doing better now. I hope so. But in thinking about the matter for the past few years, I came to believe that the Egyptians probably do not make any more litter than do we Americans. In fact, given how much litter costs before it becomes litter, I'll bet the Egyptians make less litter per capita than do we Americans. But unlike Egyptians who leave their litter to float about in the graveyard, we Americans sweep ours under the rug of Mother Earth's topsoil. And though we are better at hiding our litter, I am not at all certain we are any better at disposing it. In fact, when it comes to plastics, the likes of which make to-go coffee cups, we are told by our own Environmental Protection Agency that we only recycle 14%, which means we throw 86% of the plastics we use into the trash. All that plastic being hidden under Mother Earth's rug leads us to ask, can't we just get along without all those plastics? Well, who better to ask then Steve Wilson, who is the co-founder of Peak Plastic Foundation and the producer of the award-winning documentary, The Story of Plastics. Welcome, Steve, to the Food Chain Radio Show. So pleased to have you aboard today.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, Peak Plastic Foundation. You know, the name actually asks a question. When is peak plastic?
Well, we believe it's yesterday. Essentially, our theory of change is the only way we stop plastic pollution for good is to get at root causes, and we have to start making much, much, much less of it. And we have to think about what we're actually using it for. Is it recoverable, and does it fit into a recycling and circular economy? And so our thought is we have reached peak plastic, sort of how a lot of campaigners, 90s, early 2000s, talked about peak oil. We're sort of borrowing from that and working to bring it down.
Good. And you're also the brains, I guess, behind the movie, the Story of Plastics. So you're quite steeped in the world of plastics. I just have to ask you, as I do most all of my guests, how did you become so involved in this world? Were you like me when you found yourself wading through a cemetery filled with plastic litter? Was something like that, that caught your attention and said, I have to deal with this?
Yeah, it was sort of my origin story, as it were, goes back about 20 years ago, and I'm a surfer. I was living in Oregon at the time, and I went to a pretty remote beach. If your guests haven't been to the coastline of Oregon, there's a lot of very rugged, very unpopulated spots. And I hiked in, surfed, my dog was running on the beach, and I found all these plastic bottles with Chinese characters. And at the time, I wouldn't really call myself an environmentalist. I was a journalist at the time. And my sort of math brain said, wow, you know, this stuff's really resilient. It's, you know, it came 4,000 miles across an ocean, and it looks, you know, pretty much brand new. And then my sort of artful head said, you know, this is ugly. You know, I studied philosophy in college, and particularly aesthetics, that is the theory of beauty. And I just felt that this, you know, in this beautiful natural primeval landscape, there was this object that was just wrong aesthetically. And that got me into writing about the gyres and writing about the garbage patches. It made me seek out Captain Charlie Moore from Algorita Marine Research and Education, who discovered the garbage patch. And that led me to an expedition in the gyres. And since then, I've been working on this issue ever since.
And the documentary.
Yeah, the documentary was sort of chapter two in my career, I guess. The first part was sort of understanding the scope of the problem, taking expeditions across all the major oceans, sailing into the gyres. And then eventually, you know, you start asking questions, where is it all coming from? And you start understanding supply chains, and you start understanding globalism, and you start understanding rich and poor countries and who actually bears the burden of this plastics problem. And the two parts that we got really interested in for the story of plastic was the effect on developing world nations that we dump on and also aggressively open markets in. And then also where plastic comes from, people who live near, you know, where it's being refined, where it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's made from oil and gas, and the United States is a massive producer of fracked gas, and most of that is being turned to plastic. And people who live near where it's being made are dying. It's genocide. And so, and you know, I don't mince words when I say that.
So, and you refer to Cancer Alley in Louisiana. Tell us a little bit about what you saw, what you see happening there.
Yeah, I mean, Cancer Alley is a really important place historically, I think, in American culture. It is the stretch of Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And this is the old plantation route. This is the history of slavery. This is the history of, you know, the dark parts of America. And what has sort of what has replaced one evil is another, and that is a massive chemical corridor of like 150 plants spewing out various toxins to such a degree that the water is undrinkable and the air is unbreathable. It's simply dangerous to live in this area. And it's predominantly in communities of color. And, you know, I don't like saying the word disproportionately because it isn't actually disproportionate. It is actually intended. These are communities that are targeted. by oil and gas.
Probably not going to put your plastic factory in the Hamptons, right?
Exactly right. So this is, this is like a very dangerous place, and it's pretty sparsely populated. A lot of the younger generation is moving out because it's simply not a safe place to live. But there's also incredible activism here and incredible leadership. And our job is to sort of amplify that in the next movie we're about to make.
Aha. Well, good. Now, why is it that plastics, we're so able to take over the world economy? And, I gave a brief description of what I saw in Cairo, and you do as well, as it's everywhere. What is it about plastics that made it so ubiquitous?
Well, it's two things. It's one, it's the vehicle of globalization. So it's a way to send it's a way to send products around the world in such a way that they are preserved or not destroyed. And the problem is in countries where household incomes are lower, the companies got the bright idea to put everything in single serve pouches that are very, very difficult to recycle. And I mean difficult to recycle from a market standpoint, not from a technical standpoint. That's really the way we have to understand recycling in this day and age. It's market forces that drive it. It's not sort of altruistic or fairy and unicorns that do it.
Hasn't plastics made everything also more convenient? I mean, they're lightweight. They're easy to carry around. You can get a single serving of ketchup, and you can carry it with you on an airplane clear around the world and still use it at the other end. It just seems like plastic became so ubiquitous because it's just so convenient.
Yeah, certainly. I have a trouble with this word convenience because I don't really think it's being used correctly. Because there is, on the front end, there's a value or a perceived value of being able to take ketchup with you wherever you go. I would challenge that as a necessity. But and not to make fun of your example, but I think it actually you can extrapolate from that example and realize is my life actually better with this? And in many cases, I don't think it is. And the other problem is it's the downside that we're not talking about. And so I think when you measure the value of a material or a product, it's how does it fit in society?
What is its true cost? We're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Steve Wilson, who is the co-founder of Peak Plastic Foundation and the producer of the Emmy Award-winning documentary, The Story of Plastic. Please do stay tuned, because when we come back, we're going to talk about the true costs of convenience. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it is convenient in a really silly sort of way to be able to carry a packet, a single serving packet of ketchup around the world with you. But that's what we do. And we sell a lot of those single servings around. When did we start coming up with the whole notion of single serving plastics, Steve Wilson?
Well, it's actually a marketing ploy. I think, you know, what people don't really recognize is the demand for much of this product has been manufactured by the producer itself. It's not that the market ultimately demanded it. It was a way to get more value out of the hydrocarbons coming out of the ground when looking for fossil fuels for energy. There's all these other hydrocarbons that come out that can be used for petrochemicals or plastics. And the number one is ethane. But there was this glut of ethane that the companies were trying to figure out what to make of it, to, like, you know, because the margins on this stuff, I mean, oil and gas and plastics is an industry that only exists because it pollutes and it's subsidized by the American public. If those two things didn't happen, subsidies or pollution, or they had to pay for pollution control, it would cease to be a profitable business. But this is where the massive flood of plastics came from. And there's a pivot underway by the oil majors to plastics as a long-term growth strategy, because there is less demand from an energy and transportation standpoint. So this is a full-scale pivot, and they're trying to figure out what they can wrap plastic around and market to companies from a convenience and lifestyle standpoint. Mm-hmm. And companies are sort of eating it up.
Well, let's turn, before we go to the actual food chain and how so much of our food chain is now wrapped in plastic, I'd like to pick up the notion of recycling. Because, you know, back in the days of Earth Day, we all decided that we were going to recycle everything that we could. And, of course, plastic was a big part of that. But it turns out, according to the EPA, that we're only recycling about 14% of the plastics that we use, which means 86% of the plastics that we use are we're throwing them in the dump.
The history, as most people understand where recycling came from, is actually incorrect. So, yes, recycling started 70s, 80s, and the first municipal recycling system was in Berkeley, California. And the plastics manufacturers at the time promoted recycling and lobbied city and state governments to have plastics allowed in collection. Once that happened, there was an explosion of plastics in the market and a very aggressive marketing campaign by the oil majors telling people to recycle. Now,
wait a minute. You're saying that it wasn't the Earth Day people who were calling for recycling, it was the manufacturers of plastics that were calling for recycling?
It was both, but it was the Earth Dayers influenced by the plastics industry on the lowdown. So essentially, yes, there was good intentions by putting in recycling systems from advocates. That system was co-opted by industry as a way to get rid of the plastic that they were producing. And the thing to remember is, if recycling of plastics really worked, that is, you took a product and turned it into a product, you wouldn't need virgin material to the degree that you do. So you have to be skeptical of a company that makes plastic from virgin sources advocating for recycling as a solution, because if that solution actually worked, they'd be out of business.
And why on earth would you want to put yourself out of business? But
exactly.
If you proselytize recycling, then you can look pretty good, right? People will look
exactly
at you
right.
and say, oh, these people are heroes because they're advocating for the recycling of plastics as they keep making more and more and more plastics. Now, and when I look at plastics, I wonder how on earth you recycle that stuff anyway? And can it be cost-effective to recycle plastics?
It totally can, depending on what. I mean, plastics is a broad term for a lot of different polymers. Like, the way we understand this in sort of popular culture is we look at the bottom of a plastic container, we see a number 1 through 7. Well, the only ones that have real value in the market are number 1s and 2s, sometimes number 5s, but pretty rare. Certainly at the volume in which they're produced, none of these markets stand up. But there is a cost-effective demand for number 1 plastics, which are like water bottles, soda bottles, number 2s, which are like hard plastic, Tide laundry detergent kind of containers. Number 5 is polypropylene, which is like the caps to a water bottle.
Mm-hmm.
But the 1 and the 2s and are really easy from a mechanical recycling standpoint. And there's a high demand in the market. We actually have some domestic capacity for this kind of recycling. But otherwise, no. And then, you know, when you talk about the ketchup packet, which we did before, that's like 5 different layered materials fused together. And the cost of pulling that stuff apart, cleaning it, and turning it into feedstock for a new product is far greater than what you can sell it for.
And so much of our food chain now is wrapped in single-use plastic like that. So we are now using, according to the statistics I've seen, 1 million plastic water bottles a minute in the world. Where are these plastic water bottles being recycled? 1 million a minute.
That's a good question. I mean, that's a really hard question to answer. So most of them are being turned into textiles. So clothing, carpets, drapes, these sort of things. But you have to understand that each recycler, each person who collects recycling in business, they have contracts with cities. They're different. They have different markets, and they have different clients. So you can't answer that question accurately en masse because it's different for every market.
Wow. So it would seem to me like the big food manufacturers are very clever in their use of plastic, in that what they can do with plastic, it being such an easy thing to wrap things up with, is that they can sell smaller and smaller and smaller amounts to people who are farther and farther and farther away. And that's a pretty good money-making scheme because you can get a lot more money selling something in a small package than you can in a big package. Is that a predominant theme of the plastics world now?
Yeah, this is called the sachet economy. And for your listeners, the best way to understand a sachet is the ketchup packet or the emergency packet or the Capri Sun. These are the materials we're talking about. It's called multi-layered packaging or sachets. And in the developing world, this is the growth strategy of multinational corporations, both personal hygiene and food. And the problem is there's nowhere for this stuff to go. I think one of the biggest problems with how companies understand their impact is they look at the world as flat. They take their culture, their privilege, their background, and their understanding of systems, and they overlay it across the entire world. Well, you know, before these kind of plastics, there were a lot of traditional waste systems in developing world nations that didn't even require collection because food was composted or fed to animals. Metals were recycled. Paper was recycled. And, you know, that was pretty, glass was recycled or reused. And so you didn't have the need for these sort of formalized waste collection systems the way we have in the Western world where, you know, the truck comes down the street and picks up the bin. Well, you don't have streets in the same way. You don't have curbs. You don't have the same kind of infrastructure everywhere. So if you're introducing and designing a product for a market, you have to take into account the culture and the capacity for that market to dispose of it. And they don't. And that's why you see these pictures. And on top of that, we dump the plastic we can't recycle here on the same countries. So
what do you mean by that? What do you mean by dumping it? How do we do that?
We export it because there's no market here. So, like, when we talk about how plastic, how worthless plastic is in the grand scheme of things, let me give you an example. In Surabaya, Indonesia, I have seen shipping manifests from the port of Long Beach of bales of plastic that are literally just dumped into fields. And local villages come around and you have waste pickers who pick for valuable materials that they can pull. You know, in a typical 8 to 10 hour day of doing this work, you might earn $1.50, $2. So these waste pickers are only looking for number ones and number twos, because even at $1.50 a day labor wage, all those other plastics are not worth their time to pick up. And because more and more is coming every day, there's an endless new supply, an endless new pile.
So all of this, all of the plastics that we use here are not recycled here. They're shipped someplace else?
The vast majority. Like, I want to be very careful not to say that we don't have any domestic recycling infrastructure, because we do. However, you're going to hear from the companies, 98% of their messaging is about 2% of their management. So the popular culture, you know, understanding is that these companies are taking responsibility and making new products. What they're really doing is greenwashing and telling people they're doing good things. And that's true, but with only a very, very, very small percentage of their product line.
So most of the plastics then are baled up and put on ships.
Yep.
Was not China accepting a lot of that at one time?
It was. And China recognized that, you know, they were essentially becoming a garbage dump, because, you know, the cheapest way to get rid of any waste is to illegally dump it. You can't beat that. Dumping it on the side of the road, dumping it in water, whatever. There's no cost to doing that if you don't, you know, get caught. And so on a global scale or at a countrywide scale, we were shipping just straight contaminated garbage to China, and they were like, this is worthless stuff and it's just polluting our country. So they said no more. And that made a race to the bottom happen around the world. It's, what is the other country we can dump on? So Southeast Asia got hit. Now it's like looking to Africa. The good news is the U.S. just signed on to a treaty, United Nations environment treaty that is looking to stop the export of plastics from rich countries to poorer countries without prior consent of that country. So it's aimed to put transparency in the recycling system and to ensure that the materials being exported actually have some value to the receiving country.
And so the way they can get around that, of course, is the way they get around everything, which is to go find a decision maker and pay them a lot of money and get your chit signed off, and away you go.
Yep.
So it seems to work for a lot of different situations like that. So we have a situation here where we're manufacturing and using tons and tons and tons and millions and billions of tons of plastics, and we don't really have anywhere place to get rid of them. Is that what I'm hearing? Other than dumping them?
Yeah, it accumulates. Like, the best way to think of this is a snowstorm that's happening very slowly compared to a real snow. But the stuff accumulates. And it will continue to accumulate. So if 10 years ago you saw, plastic on the side of the roadside, it's going to be double in 10 years and double in 10 years and double. And it will just increase because there's nowhere for it to go.
And it's just going to keep building and building and building. And don't we do a great job of hiding that here in the United States? I mean, having been around the world and here and there in a lot of developing nations, it always looks so depressing to see the amount of trash, and especially plastics, just laying about. I once had an excursion in Cairo, and then from there I went directly to Indianapolis, Indiana, to give a presentation, and found Indianapolis, Indiana to be the cleanest place on earth. And I was so incredibly impressed. But we use probably more than they do in Egypt. So I want to ask you about that disparity when we get back from this break. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Steve Wilson and you right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we do live in a very clean country when it gets right down to it. You can drive down the street and you, without seeing a lot of litter next to the road. And for the most part, most of our cities are very well tended and clean. But I got to thinking about that with respect to an experience I had in Cairo. And I got to thinking that we must use more disposable plastics than they use. And I say that simply by virtue of the fact that before the litter becomes litter, it's very expensive stuff. You know, it's wrapped around expensive products that we can afford probably better than any place else in the world. So I suspect we use a lot more per capita than somebody, for example, in Egypt. Stiv, am I off base on that?
No, you're correct. You're totally correct. The U.S. has the highest per capita. I think the second is Japan. The use of plastics. I think the disparity that you're seeing is, one, the way products are designed in the U.S., they have a better chance of making it into the waste management system. So, like, if, for example, if you're consuming a bottle of shampoo, it's gonna live in your shower, and until it's gone, which, you know, probably is a month or something like that. And then, how is that? Even if you want it to litter, how is that really going to get out of your house? It's not. It's going to go into the waste system. So, yes, we do in fact consume more by weight, but not necessarily by number. So what we were talking about earlier is the small packages of, you know, if we take the shampoo example, same volume would probably take 150 little packages.
Like going to a hotel or something.
Yes. And those have a much better chance of escaping the waste system, especially if they're being sold in a country that doesn't have the same kind of waste collection system. But, like, let's be really clear. The U.S. is not clean. I disagree with that. Sure, there are parts that are very, very pristine, but I've seen the same level of plastic pollution in corners of this country. I mean, when it starts to rain after the dry season in Los Angeles, look at the L.A. River. I mean, this is on par with any terribly plastic polluted watershed in the world. So I think we are better at hiding it. What we consume by weight is more, but not by number. And so what you're seeing in Cairo is you're seeing products that are not designed appropriately for the culture that they are appearing in, and they escape the waste stream as such.
Well, they certainly do not have, you know, the management systems that we have, that's for sure. So where are they to go? What are people to do with their trash and their litter? What are they supposed to do with it? And I kind of thought about that as I found myself carrying a paper cup, a plastic cup down the street. And what am I supposed to do with this plastic cup? There's no place for it. There's no, not a lot of garbage cans available because nobody knows what to do with the garbage cans if they had one that was filled up with stuff. So, but here in the United States, we're very good at hiding things by burying them. But that doesn't get rid of them, does it?
No. I mean, the biodegradation of plastics is, you know, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It doesn't go away in a meaningful time frame at all. So it is accumulating. And I think, you know, one story I'd love to share from the story of plastic sort of illustrates this problem really well. In India, when we were shooting, we were in Delhi and we were in an open air market. And, you know, you can buy tea just about every 10 feet. Indians drink tea consistently all day. It's very deep, steeped in their culture, if you could excuse the pun. But it was very normal to get a small glass of tea on the street, stand there and drink it. And I, in this market, I now saw this being served in small plastic cups. And as soon as this man finished drinking his tea, I saw him throw the cup to the ground very hard and then walk off. And I asked my colleague what this was about. And she said, oh, he's an old guy. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, it used to be that you would get tea in the streets and unfinished clay cups, you know, that were not fired. They were very cheap to produce. And the tradition is once you finish the tea, you would smash it on the ground and it would turn to dust and just become a part of the street.
Dust no to problem. Dust, yeah.
But that man was trained to think the same way and dispose of the product the same way, but that product isn't going away. And that's the dissonance we're facing at a global scale.
So, Steve, we see an endless machine that's just cranking out plastics by the zillions of tons, and it has nowhere to go. So, what are we going to do?
Well, that's the great question. I think the advantage we have working on this issue is the evidence keeps mounting because of the nature of the material. Climate change is inherently harder to get people to understand empirically. Everybody understands plastic because they use it. I mean, we touch plastic more than we touch our loved ones. So the evidence is continuing to mount. The pivot to renewable energy sources will disrupt and change the markets and the calculus for pulling fossil fuels out of the ground, refining them, and turning them into products. So it is, I hate to say it this way, but it is the you know, the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I feel that we're wading very deeply down a dangerous path, but the evidence is continuing to be overwhelming. And I think that and the talents of campaigners and the increasing power of people in the grassroots, frontline, and developing world in this space are getting stuff done. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things to be hopeful for as well.
But it sounds like what you're saying, we have to be hopeful for the fact that we drown in this plastic and then we'll wake up to the fact that we've drowned in the plastic. I hope that's not the case. You know, Steve, one of the things that I think is the biggest problem of modern times is the distorting effects of subsidies. And I look at plastics and I see that principle in action because I see that we're making plastics that are too expensive to recycle. Now, if we were to actually account for the true cost of that plastic, wouldn't we have to charge then also for the cost of recycling it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is the grand philosophy that has to be adopted by capitalistic systems if capitalism is going to benefit everyone. Now, you know, that's a tall order, but, you know, this is the crux of the situation is we have to have a strategy for anything that we're putting into the world to have it be remanufactured into something that goes into the world. We have resource scarcity on this planet from everything from precious metals to fossil fuels to water to you name it. So the future is all about creating a circular model that you know, better mimics the natural processes of decay and regeneration. And I don't mean to sound woo-woo at all about this. I think that's one of the problems is environmentalists talk about this world and people think of it as like an ancient world, and I think of it as a very sophisticated modern world.
You know, I think about the single-use ketchup packet that we've been talking about, kind of like the holy grail of modern times, right? And I think about how they give them away at the fast food place. You know, here, how many of these ketchups do you want? 50 or what? And so they're very, very cheap. But they're really not very, very cheap. What if they were charged the true costs of disposing of those plastic packets? So instead of handing you one or a dozen of them free, they would have to say, well, this is going to cost $2.50. You know, how many do you want? Do you think that might change things?
We've seen some mechanisms in the policy world that are similar to that have been a deterrent. Like fees on plastic bags, for example, reduce 70-80% of them in the market. And, you know, in well-run systems that have adopted a fee policy on plastic bags, people are saying, well, why don't you just ban them? Well, what's interesting is the revenue generated from the 30% that people are paying for goes into remediation costs. So you're actually getting a net benefit to the environment of also being able to clean up what's there. So there are systems in place that work, but the vast majority of products that you use every single day, they don't have the ability to have a true cost sort of calculus applied to them, because if they were, they wouldn't be profitable. They just simply wouldn't exist.
So
I mean, think about this.
Yeah, the same.
Like, remember this. They let you walk out of the store with your product in a package that they do not care if they get back. That means it's worthless.
Right. If there's no recyclable fee on them, that means they're not worth taking back. So
right.
Huh. There it is. And one thing that always puzzled me about this whole notion of plastic bags at the grocery store is, why did we get rid of paper bags? Because paper bags are something that can be recycled. And yet we got rid of the paper bags for plastic bags. Now, was that something that was sponsored by the plastics industry?
No, I mean, not exactly. I mean, they worked very hard to say that the climate change footprint or carbon footprint of plastics was much lower than paper. So, you know, it was essentially a marketing scheme of competing from a greener perspective. Well, one, the analysis of the carbon being burned to make plastics is totally inaccurate. It's only a piece of the picture that they choose to focus on. So no, it's not actually less carbon intensive than paper. But that has been their sort of marketing ploy to get every sustainability director at a major corporation to believe that paper is coming from a boreal forest in the Amazon and plastic is coming from, you know, places that don't cause any climate change.
So it kind of was a marketing scam. It seemed to me it just didn't make any sense whatsoever to me. Well, I wonder, Steve Wilson, for somebody who lives this world of plastics, most of us, of course, go to the grocery store and carry home big bundles of plastic and kind of curse them a little bit, but don't really think about them. You think about them all the time. Do you think, you know, we can come to a place in the world where we can live without all that plastic and be happy?
Yeah, I think it's actually working against our happiness in so many ways. I think, you know, increasingly in my generation, I'm 49 years old, and certainly in the younger generation, there is this agita or angst that you know something is wrong in the world, like just inherently. And I think that anxiety is actually lessening our quality of life. These themes of climate change, environmental degradation, human rights, they have an effect on our psyches, and they have an effect on our mental well-being. And I don't think plastic is what makes us happy, and I don't think it's convenience that makes us happy. Because what I find makes people happy is having more time in the day, having fresh food, having a table to gather around, and a good conversation at night. Like, these are things that don't require this sort of convenience lifestyle. And sure, there's people who, you know, I mean, every Netflix series is about some urban narcissist at this point.
Yeah, but, you know, with respect to that conversation, I'll bet, you know, a good jug of a boxed wine in a plastic jug might help. But thank you, Steve Wilson, for bringing us to become more aware of that trash that we're drowning in. Steve Wilson, the story of plastic and the Peak Plastic Foundation. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you so much. Check us out at Peak Plastic on the socials, and watch out for our next film. Working title is Goliath is Wobbling.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.